And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I don't know whether you caught much of Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who's recently resigned from Egypt's Shura Council in support of the Tamarod movement that brought down the Morsi government. But of course, the main question I had for her was that have Tamarod and again the secular liberal forces, have they been used by the military in the sense that they brought about the second revolution as they did the first, but the military appeared to have grabbed power, and that Saudi Arabia had played a role behind the scenes. She was quite skeptical of both of those charges, even though there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Saudi Arabia has played a fairly important, if not pivotal, role in both undermining the Morsi government and rewarding the new government.
Well, I think on the one hand, of course, the Saudis were opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and were opposed to Morsi. And so I think that his fall, the seizure of power by the military, certainly serves Saudi interests. I don't know that we can necessarily trace backwards direct Saudi influence. We like to overstate the power and the ability of larger players, both in the region and outside, most importantly the United States, having the ability to dictate events. And I think it's hard to conclusively determine that that's in fact the case here, that the Saudis have been pivotal. Shortly after the military's coup, of course, they promised $5 billion in aid, and they would like to capitalize on transformations that are now taking place. But to say that the Saudis somehow had a role in 30 million people taking to the streets is overstating by a long shot their ability to shape events in the region.
Well, but the question is, did the 30 million in the streets, just as 2 years ago, many of those same people took to the streets, are they really in control of Egypt's destiny, or are the military and the old guard? Because another coincidence, if you will, is that all of the shortages that plagued the Morsi government now appear to be over. And more importantly, the police, who were absent from the streets, suddenly are back on the streets.
Right. Well, we have the New York Times report that the gas lines, or that the gas was sort of mysteriously returned in suitable quantities, that the electricity is back on, which suggests some sort of collusion prior to June 30th between the military, the police, and the protest movement. That very well may be the case, that there has been some backdoor operation and maneuvering going on. But still, I think it's attributing to things more power than they actually have. The reality is we're in the middle of something. I don't see this as a second revolution. I mean, I'm part of the editorial collective at Middle East Report, which had an editorial out just a few days ago that said this distinction between coup and revolution is the wrong question to ask. We're in the middle of a world historical event. What happened this over the last 2 weeks is connected to what happened in 2011. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's easy to focus on the moment and to try to guess and ask questions about what role the military is going to play. We don't know. But what we do know is that 30 million people turned out expressing democratic aspiration. That they've done it for the second time in 2 years is really quite remarkable. And I was talking to a colleague of mine a couple of days ago, and it's remarkable. If we want to compare this historically to other revolutions, the French didn't storm Bastille twice. Egyptians have revolted and mobilized popularly twice. For whatever reason, they believe that they hold a considerable amount of power. We know that there's now an outline or a roadmap for a new constitution, new elections in Egypt over the next 6 months. I think we need to see what happens and determine whether or not Egyptians are satisfied with that before we know what the political landscape is going to look like.
And of course, that was an appropriate allusion, Toby Jones. But today being 14 juillet, the 14th of July, the storming of the anniversary, if you will, of the storming of the Bastille. And of course, the American Revolution started in 1776 and wasn't really over till 1789. So clearly, you don't have overnight governments in any historical context. That's not to say, though, that there's not a rivalry, shall we say, between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Recently, when they were meeting in Doha over the future of the Syrian rebels, the Free Syrian Army versus the Saudi surrogates, which appear to be more of the al-Nusra types, Qatar, of course, supports the Muslim Brotherhood, as does the government in Turkey, which is in effect, a Muslim Brotherhood government. So you have throughout the region, you have people that are for the Muslim Brotherhood, like Turkey, like Qatar, and of course the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood that's just fallen. And then you have people like King Hussein, who has problems with his own opposition in terms of a Muslim Brotherhood movement, which he of course opposes. And then you have the Saudis, who let's get to that basic question. Does this monarchy fear an alternative Islamic rule of a more Islamic democracy than the autocratic system that they have in Saudi Arabia that uses the Wahhabis as their kind of pious front, if you will?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the Saudis fear the power of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are working at cross purposes against Qatar, against Turkey, against Hamas, and certainly against the Brotherhood in Egypt. The Saudis would like nothing more than to see good old-fashioned military-dominated autocracies across the region. They have no investment. I mean, we need to keep this very simple point in mind when thinking about the Saudis and their geopolitical interests. They are pragmatic. They have a clear sense of what serves their interests. And the best thing is for there not to be a vibrant ideological landscape across the region. The Saudis want autocrats and tyrants to be in power in order to stabilize the region. Now, the reasons that they aspire to this, I think, are twofold. And one is a kind of general, perhaps abstract sensibility that they're anxious about what democratic politics might mean, no matter what shape it takes, whether it's Islamists or whether it's something else. They would hate for there to be a further demonstration effect. But there's something else at play here that's specific to the ideology and the historic role of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that is to say that the Saudis from the late 70s into the 1980s faced their own domestic political opposition movement that was rooted in the regional Muslim Brotherhood. And the Saudis, I think, are not only operating out of a sense of regional anxiety, but are attuned to their own domestic history and the power and the potential power of the Muslim Brotherhood to challenge them at home. So I think it's for these two reasons. One is, you know, anxiety is generally about the possibility of democracy, as well as their specific discomfort with the Muslim Brotherhood historically in the region.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Jones, who's professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. So, if this is a surrogate struggle going on, and we know in the broader sense in the Middle East there's a surrogate war going on or a power struggle, however you want to characterize it, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Syria, of course, is often referred to as a proxy war. But within that proxy war, there are also another proxy war, and that seems to be between Qatar's support for the Free Syrian Army and by extension the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saudi Arabia's support apparently for the more radical forces of al-Nusra and these others. Now, you've already had evidence that within the Syrian civil war, there's a war that could possibly break out between the rebels' factions, with Three Syrian Army commander recently being shot by an al-Nusra Front rebel. And I think the al-Nusra people captured a couple of Free Syrian Army people and beheaded them. So do you think that, first of all, do you accept the premise that there are proxy wars within proxy wars?
I absolutely do. I do think that you've got the Saudis and the Qataris and others, you know, working for, you know, their own interests and own advantage. And the Syrians pay the heaviest price for all of this. But I absolutely agree that that the battlefield in Syria is muddled. Who counts as the opposition? Who counts as pro-regime? It really obscures the terrible ways that there are cleavages, particularly on the opposition side of things, that could potentially become combustible. And they're certainly long-term toxic. If we've not learned anything from Afghanistan, it's that while these forces are unleashed in a particular battlefield, they seem to serve the interests of their patrons. But once the fighting in Syria is over, I think you'll see the potential for spillover and for this to have a life of its own. And the Saudis are definitely, the Saudis are driving the hardest in making things both as less clear as possible, but also as difficult to manage as possible.
And Toby Jones, fairly recently I spoke with a member of the Saudi opposition, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, and he was saying that Saudi Arabia is repeating what happened during the Afghan war against the Soviet Union, in the sense that they're emptying their jails, and the judges are giving young Saudi dissidents a choice. Either you go to jail or you go off to fight, in this case, not in Afghanistan, but in Syria. Is that going on, to your understanding?
I think that's one very powerful interpretation of things. I mean, I don't have any material evidence to suggest that it's true, but I think that it's right, and I do think that Syria now is more like Afghanistan in the 80s than, say, the Iraq Jihad during the period of the American occupation. I think in that case, the Saudis were nervous about providing direct political cover for the jihadis, although Saudis were making their way to Iraq. Here, the Saudis are much more directly involved in providing weapons and materiel for their favored actors in Syria, and it does look an awful lot like Afghanistan.
So on the other side, on the Qatari side, who support the Muslim Brotherhood, and they, after all, Qatar has lent Egypt more than $7 billion during Morsi's year in power, so they're putting their money where their mouth is. What is the reasons behind this Gulf monarchy, which is not unlike the Saudi ruling family? Why do they support this broader democratic experiment that the Muslim Brotherhood represent, as opposed to the it's a monarchy. Maybe it has a more friendly face than the Al Saud monarchy, but the Al Thanis are still absolute rulers, aren't they?
Well, they are. I think that we have to be careful. There is a Qatari, and there is also a Saudi version of criminology that's certainly possible here. It's difficult to crawl inside the heads of the key actors, particularly in what is a relatively short period after a transfer of power in Qatar, to know exactly what's going on. I think the Qataris are less committed to anything in particular than they are in embellishing and strengthening their own profile. I mean, over the past decade or so, they've played an outsized role in the region, certainly outsized geographically, but also their historic role has never been particularly pronounced. And I think that in the last 2 years, the Qataris have latched on to the Muslim Brotherhood, particularly in Egypt, but also in Syria, building alliances with Turkey as a way to establish themselves. They thought that they picked winners. I don't know that there's an ideological angle here, or at least not one that was there 3 or 4 years ago. It may have become the case more recently. But I simply think that the Qataris thought that they had, that they had picked the winning team, and that they were going to roll with that, and found themselves, unfortunately for them, on the wrong side.
But in the broader sense, though, doesn't in many ways the shadow of Algeria hang over this whole issue that's happening in Egypt, which is the idea that a lot of Western analysts, particularly on the neoconservative side, see Islamic democracy as one man, one vote, one time. And that was the fear that happened in Algeria some years back, where the Islamic Salvation Front, the FIS, looked like they were about to win the elections, and the military stepped in and annulled the elections. And what ensued was a very, very bloody civil war in which at least 200,000 people were slaughtered. So surely if this is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, if you treat the Muslim Brotherhood as though they are like the FIS, that you can't trust them, that you give them democracy and then they turn it into theocracy, the former member of Egypt's Shura Council, Dr. Mona Makrim Abid, was saying earlier was that she feels and is very insistent that they're going to bring the Muslim Brotherhood back into the political process. So what's your sense on how you do that? Because I would think if I were a member of the Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, I'd be beginning to think maybe that they don't believe that we are capable of participating in the democratic process. It's like in a marriage accusing your spouse of having an affair when they didn't really have an affair. You see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, I think there's a couple of things to tease out here. On the one hand, you know, the Tamarud movement, I think expressed a similar set of anxieties and frustrations with the political and economic system in Egypt that ousted Mubarak. And that is to say that Mubarakism lived on under the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi was more interested in consolidating the power of the Brotherhood at the expense of real democratic politics. So we shouldn't get too caught up in calling the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist Democrats. They largely have themselves to blame for the anger that ousted them from power in June 30th, as well as obviously the collusion of the military with the protest movement. But I also think that the Muslim Brotherhood actually operates better. It's a more effective and kind of has a greater degree of coherence when it is an opposition movement and is outside of power. And for that reason, I think it does need to be included in the political system. One would hope that they'll participate if given the advantage, but I can also, it's easy to anticipate that they'd elect to opt out precisely as you suggested because they won't trust it. They won't trust that it will provide the kinds of protections that are necessary for them to be active and to participate. And here again, I think we have to wait and see exactly what's going to happen. If the military continues to slaughter people and to behave as it did in the middle of 2011, then Egypt has long-term problems. And it'll be up to the military to yield that kind of political power. I don't think the military wants de jure political authority, but are they willing to allow democracy to sort of flourish, one that includes the Brotherhood, a system that includes, I simply, at this point, nobody knows.
Well, just in closing then, Toby Jones, let's assume that they're able to, this transitional government is able to shift from military rule to civilian rule, and that they lay the groundwork, as Dr. Mona Makrim Abid was suggesting, for a real parliament, a real lower house, and that they have free and fair and open elections and that everybody participates. If that were the case, and that's certainly a pretty big wish list there, how do you think the Muslim Brotherhood would fare in a free and fair elections after what's happened?
Well, at this point, given the turnout on June 30th, I don't think they'd fare particularly well, at least not as well as they did in 2012. I do think the political polling, opinion polling, and others demonstrated and showed quite conclusively that the Brotherhood had lost a great deal of support from the elections up to the point of June 30th. They were not the most popular political network in the country as they had been previously. I mean, this is what happens to electorates, right? They're educated, they learn, there's something pedagogical about elections and about the democratic experiment and process. That is, that people can evaluate in a transparent process how those that they put in positions of authority behave. The Muslim Brotherhood didn't behave democratically, so it's no wonder that millions of people who believed that they had created the conditions for something new, something non-autocratic, were ready to throw the Brotherhood out of power.
Well, Toby Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case.
شهداء ومهمهم شي يموتوا بهوى ينزفوا شهداء